I come into the office of SNEB president with a deep sense of gratitude, responsibility, opportunity, and actually an overwhelming sense of urgency. I'll explain the latter first to get the kind of stress-inducing part of my talk out of the way, and then get to what I hope will inspire you to explore possibilities and opportunities in your work as practitioners, academics, advocates, and researchers. The mere fact that we have this dynamic combination of professional spheres in our membership and the fact that we have 27 countries represented in our membership is indeed a real strength for harnessing a greater impact. But I ask you now to indulge me in getting my feelings of urgency off my chest. The day I started this talk, I was sitting in a part of my house which has no air conditioning. In fact, at that point, none of the house had any air conditioning in the Northeast where I live, and a large swath of the country was suffering through a heat wave. That day, the mercury was predicted to be 97 degrees, and with a heat index, thanks to the region's typical humidity, that was expected to travel well north of 105 degrees. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, much of Europe is experiencing record high temperatures, and did so in June, and then that heat continued and returned in July, with exceptionally hot weather in Western Europe, setting new all-time high temperature records in four countries. So as I was sitting down to write my speech, it was difficult, if not impossible, to think about the first cause of my feelings of urgency, climate change, and to be disheartened by how painfully little has been done on a cooperative and global scale to address it. This is especially in the face of mounting evidence and agreement. 99% of scientists, Josh had told me the other day, agree that climate change trends over the past century are extremely likely due to human activities. Maddeningly, solutions to the problem were at hand when I first learned about the greenhouse effect in the 1990s as an undergraduate in a food and nutrition program at Huxley College of Environmental Studies at Western Washington University. I remember well the original Earth Day in 1970 and the excitement and hope that surrounded it. But sadly, efforts to achieve meaningful policy change, controls on greenhouse gas emissions, and energy regulations came so close, but ultimately failed to be enacted. As David Wallace Wells makes abundantly clear in this book, The Uninhabitable Earth, a no-holds-barred account of what we can expect as climate change progresses, we are in for a whole lot of pain and suffering unless radical changes are made in every aspect of our lives, in public policies and economic systems. And our window of opportunity for not exceeding the 2 degrees global warming temperature that temperature increase that scientists believe will spell catastrophe, that window is closing very fast. Another cause of my sense of urgency is what is happening to nature overall. In May of 2019, the United Nations released a policymaker's summary of its global assessment report on biodiversity and ecosystem services, considered to be the most comprehensive assessment of global nature loss ever. The report's bottom line is that 1 million of the planet's known 8 million species, and that's just the known 8 million species, is threatened with extinction. The report paints a bleak picture, not bedtime reading for you, a planet, quote, ravaged by ever-growing human population whose insatiable consumption is destroying the natural world. In an earlier paper published in Science, Rodolfo Durso and colleagues describe what is termed the defaunization in the Anthropocene and credits humans with the cause. They say, we live amid a global wave of anthropogenically driven biodiversity loss, species and populations exportations that critically declines in local species abundance. So these planetary perils, climate change and species extinctions, are increasingly seen as intertwined with poor nutritional health globally in all its forms, including obesity, undernutrition, and other dietary risks. The Lancet Commission report in February of 2019 claims that three pandemics, obesity, undernutrition, and climate change, quote, represent the global syndemic that affects most people in every country and region worldwide. They constitute a syndemic or synergy of epidemics because they co-occur in time and place, interact with each other to produce complex sequelae, and share common underlying societal drivers. The major systems drivers of the global syndemic, the report suggests, are food and agriculture, transportation, urban design, and land use. So it should be fairly obvious that the lines that connect these drivers to food nutrition issues, such as access to healthy food, food consumption, the food supply, is quite a short line. There is much more that I could say about the dire state of the planet and how the poor will suffer the most and how the lack of political will to act exacerbates the situation. But transferring my stress and sense of urgency onto you is not my real purpose today. Maybe it's partly, a little bit of purpose. But I'd rather like us to think about now what we can do as nutrition educators, academics, researchers, and advocates, and what we as the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior can contribute to the solution. I believe that we are perfectly poised as leaders to be leaders not only in improving quality of diets in individuals and families, but in the effort to combat climate change, address the syndemics, and put the brakes on rapid decline of nature. And while it may seem that we're all doomed, practically every report, including the book that I had the cover for, gives some hope and says that there are ways to reverse this if we act now. The question is, will we act, and how will we act? So I believe it is critical for the society, if we are to retain, regain, and expand our relevance, to lead efforts to promote food-related behaviors that not only enhance human health, but restore planetary health. The two are linked, and nutrition education bridges the after-the-swallow considerations, like nutrients, diets, and health, with the before-the-swallow considerations, production, processing, packaging, and transportation. Clearly, we need to reduce chronic disease through changes in diet, and this will always be a primary reason that we do nutrition education. We know that non-communicable diseases claim thousands of lives and respond to dietary change. Further, the fact that diets diverge significantly from recommendations, as shown in this graphic from the 2015-2020 dietary guidelines, will be also continue to be a key driver or justification for nutrition education. In other words, an essential aspect of nutrition education is and will continue to be the integration of nutrition, diet, and health science with theories of behavior change to deliver programs to increase motivation, skills, knowledge, and provide environmental supports to promote behavior change. In this traditional model of nutrition education, the primary outcome is health or decreased risk of chronic disease. But if we are to come to recognize and fully appreciate that human health and planetary health are inextricably linked, then we need to adopt a more complex framework for nutrition education, one that includes evidence related to sustainability, planetary boundaries, and how food choices impact the natural ecosystems, and thus ones that reshape food environments, policy, and systems. The outcomes of our work need to be twofold: human health and planetary health. Differences in nutrition content provide the basis for much of what we do in nutrition education, but foods also differ in their planetary resource content, if you will, the ecological, social, and economic impacts exerted by the type of food system that produce them. What we need is nutrition education that integrates these. Our society has very important tools in this area, and they've already been mentioned by Jen McCaffrey. We have a set of competencies that includes food policy, agricultural production, and food systems to define our profession. This past January, also mentioned by Jen, was our very first independent position paper that stated that environmental sustainability should be an integral part of dietary guidance, whether working with individuals, groups on their food choices, or setting national dietary guidelines. These are great steps in the right direction that the society has taken. What else can we do as practitioners, academics, research, and advocates? In our nutrition education programs, integrating human and planetary health needs to become the norm. We need to ask what food knowledge and skills do people need in order to enhance their own health while lowering their environmental impact? How can we heighten planetary health as a motivating factor in food choices and related behaviors? What we could do is start with something that's, you know, pretty familiar to us, like choose your favorite behavioral change theory. For example, in the health belief model, we could look at the construct perceived benefits. In addition to the proximal health benefit, a perceived benefit of health, from eating, for example, more vegetables, such as reducing cancer or other chronic diseases, we could include more distal but critical ecological benefits, such as protecting groundwater, essential pollinators, soil microbes, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, then we would need to think about and ask, what is our role in policy and food systems change to make sure that such choices are accessible, affordable, and available to everyone in communities? The planetary health diet that was recently proposed by the EAT Commission's Lancet report is a laudable attempt to link food choices with environmental impacts. Globally, and especially in North America, as shown here, currently intake, particularly of meat, animal products, starchy foods, far exceeds what the Commission concluded is needed to respect planetary boundaries. Another implication of integrating planetary and individual health and nutrition is grounding our practice in community and geographic context. What does it mean? What does eating seasonally and choosing from a local agriculture look like in your area? In my region of the northeastern United States, this means that the oil would be maybe grapeseed oil or rapeseed oil. In winter, a salad would include cabbages. We have beautiful cabbage in the winter. It stores like crazy. It's really good. And this picture of the jar of sprouting seeds is taken from my kitchen. I love sprouting seeds in my kitchen. You'll never get a fresher green. It's kind of tiny, but it's a fresh green. And I love experimenting with different seeds that sprout. Food and nutrition education is empowering and can help the public address environmental concerns that consumers are voicing. I've been hearing a lot about consumer concern about single-use plastic. And it is pretty darn hard if you're trying to not bring any more plastic into your home in the food you buy to find products that aren't wrapped in some way in plastic. So one of the things that my husband and I started doing at the beginning of the year was, well, what can we make that always comes in a plastic container and we can make in our kitchen? So we started with hummus. And I love our hummus. I like it better than what we bought at the store, and we're not using a plastic container when we do that. And it freezes really well. So Carlos Monteiro, who spoke yesterday morning at the Bring Symposium, recommends that we prioritize types of food by the extent and the type of processing that it has undergone. So how can we best achieve this approach to improve health outcomes and acknowledge planetary boundaries and transform the food system? We need to ask what will help consumers make choices in the marketplace based on environmental criteria. Beyond calories, ingredients, and nutrient content of foods, can food labels provide information about environmental impacts, such as shown here, from a New York Times article by Jane Brody, greenhouse gas emissions from different kinds of foods. What role can nutrition educators play in developing environmental and social indicators for consumers in researching their effectiveness and impact on food choices? I think the research potentials for this kind of approach are quite large. And one idea that I've been coming up with lately is rethinking nutrition education through the development of a podcast that I'm calling Climate Kitchen. In each episode, a chef, climate scientist, and a nutrition educator will discuss the evidence related to the climate implications of the ingredients that the chef might choose for the recipe, all the while preparing a very nutritious and easy to prepare and delicious dish. It should also concern us that the power in the food system is concentrated in the hands, or I should say the boardrooms, of a small number of very large companies. What is power? And when it comes to the food supply, why does it matter? Or does it matter? I learned recently how the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. defined power. In the 1968 speech he delivered to the striking sanitation workers in Memphis, he defined power as the ability to achieve purpose and effect change. The ability to achieve purpose and effect change. One of the reasons I really like this definition is that, in addition to the fact that it is concise and accurate, it also makes clear that power is not inherently good or bad. It's how power is used determines if, in the case of food supply, if it promotes health and sustainability, or it undermines them. Certainly, this is a picture of concentration and control in a few big leaguers, as you might call them. It is not what some would think of as a democratic food system. Individuals as food citizens have the power to change, control, and shift control in the food system. But as shapers of food policy, nutrition educators can wield a lot more power. Therefore, the dominance of the food industry influence on the development of the dietary guidelines should also concern us. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, more than half of the committee members come from either clear strings with industry-funded research or questionable membership in industry-funded advocacy groups or foundations. Such conflicts of interest are once again exerting pressure on the dietary guidelines process and make sure that the committee doesn't stray from the diet and health questions that they have been assigned despite substantial evidence related to diet and sustainability. Since the DGAC reviewed the science on sustainability for the current dietary guidelines, the evidence base in this area has exploded. If the dietary guidelines committee wanted to address questions such as, how do foods differ in their greenhouse gas emissions? By law, it could. Is it a matter of political will and the ability to act in the face of pressure from powerful interests? What can the Society for Nutrition and Education and Behavior do? As Stephanie Feldstein writes in The Hill, the 2020-25 Dietary Guidelines for Americans will have serious consequences for the climate, food security, and public health that will extend well beyond the next 5 years. Does SNEB have the will to speak up? So as I step into the role as president, I see great potential for our society. And I'm putting up a picture of potential collaborations with new partners and existing partners. We have talent, expertise, camaraderie, and so much affection for one another. That is power. We have passion, and I believe we do have the will to play a role in solving the grand challenges of climate change, species extinction, and syndemics. And importantly, we work in and help develop communities. We are a community. So I encourage you to think about these things. Think about how you can shift, tweak those lessons that you do in your communities. Think about new research questions, and I invite your ideas in the coming year. Thank you very much.